You are an energetic being first and foremost, so the quality of your energy field is really important. It works like a filter, each part of the field enabling or preventing whatever is turning up in your life. This is the Future Self Energetics Show. I'm your host, Amanda Nelson, and I work in the body, mind, and spirits community. I'm an award-winning master energist. That's a therapist that specializes in improving the quality of the energy fields that move in, through, and around your body. If you want anything in your life to change, you have to begin with changing your energy field first. So my shows are a mixture of talk and therapy ideas, interviews, and thought-provoking inspiration. They're all about energy, energy fields, protection, and connection. If there's a topic you'd love me to cover in my show, please email me, amanda@futureselfenergetics.com. And if you love the show here on UK Health Radio, please spread the word about it in your networks. What have I got on the show for you this week? Well, this week I decided I wanted to share some discoveries with you. Discoveries about the origins for some of the essential ingredients to creating that happy, festive celebration that we all love at this time of the year. I'm going to be looking at song and decorations and gifts in the show this week. I want you to see how these three key ingredients had originated, how they have continued, and to some extent, how they have changed over the years as well.
The station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
I decided this week I wanted to share some discoveries with you on my show today. Discoveries about the origins for some of the essential ingredients to creating that happy, festive celebration that we all love this time of the year. I'm going to be looking at song and decorations and gifts. I wanted to see how these three key ingredients had originated, how they have continued or changed over the years. You know, where did they start and what was the meaning behind them when they first came about? Where did the use of song and decoration and gift actually come from? I thought I'd have a look at singing and songs first. I mean, we all love our songs at Christmas, don't we? Eventually, these Christmas songs do become songs we love to hate, though, don't they? It happens every year. We then take a rest for 11 months, and then we can't wait to hear them again. When I was much, much younger, around the age of 6 or 7, I can remember going from doorstep to doorstep in my local neighbourhood in order to raise money at Christmas for my favourite children's charity of the time. It was Dr. Bernardo's, and Dr. Bernardo's, as I knew it, helped to transform the lives of the most vulnerable children and young people in the UK, children who were much less fortunate than I was at the time. Now, the collection box that I held in my little hands was designed to look like a little home, and I would go out with my parents and some of my friends as well, and we would go and sing traditional Christmas carols on our neighbours' doorsteps, and we did it in order to raise charitable donations for this children's charity. We'd sing all the favourites, including Away in a Manger and Jingle Bells and Silent Night. And all we expected in return for a few songs sung on this chilly doorstep were some coppers, some pennies dropped into the slit in the roof of that house-shaped donations box. You know, and if we were lucky, we might get an occasional mince pie too. What I didn't know, though, was that caroling originated, way before the Christian traditions actually originated from the pre-Christian wassailing tradition, the villages of the time that all grouped together as a crowd, and they would walk through the local fields and orchards in the middle of the winter, and they would sing. They didn't only sing, actually, sometimes they would even shout, because they were making a huge amount of noise in order to drive away any spirits that might get in the way of abundant crops in the following year. It certainly wasn't in the hope of receiving a charitable donation back then. Wassailing was a kind of fertility rite, and it was intended to drive away anything that might prevent the new growth that was needed to flourish and produce food and nourishment for the year ahead. That rebirth theme, that resurrection theme, is really common in most of the traditional belief systems. I mean, of course it would be. It promised that although everything seemed to have gone, it hadn't really. And it would soon be resurrected, brought back to life again. Resurrection, to be restored to life. All traditions have some version of a resurrection story, and especially around the winter time. It would seem that nature has died. All that remained is the hope of rebirth, the hope that Mother Nature would be restored again to her full bounty, to her former glory, and then all would be well and plentiful. Traditional wassailing then changed into what became known as carolling, going from door to door, singing to the health of your neighbours. As the song lyrics go, good tidings we bring to you and your kin. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Carolling in churches was a relatively new tradition, starting as recently as the 1200s. Although songs of praise of all kinds would have been used much earlier than that. Now, in the 21st century, we have CDs, MP3s and all forms of media that bring wassailing to us around the clock from early December onward, and in the comfort of our own home too. You don't have to step outside and face the biting chill at all. I'll never forget how cold my hands and feet felt by the time we finally returned home. But there was always plenty of piping hot tomato soup, and once our boots and coats had been put away, once we were warmed up that little bit again, it was time to join in as we counted up all the donations we'd received in that little house-shaped Bernardo's box. Then we'd write down the total on a scrap of paper ready to be taken to the bank, to be sent off to the children who were not as fortunate as we were. So let's take a short break, and then next I'd like to tell you what I know about the festive tradition of decorating the house. This is the Future Self Energetic Show for UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Amanda Nelson, and I decided I'd share some discoveries with you on my show today. I've been looking into the origins of some of the essential must-haves for a happy festive celebration. You see, I'm looking at song, decoration and gifts over the festive season, both historically in earlier times and also as we celebrate the festive season now. Where did those traditions originate? What was the meaning behind them? Where did the use of song and decorations and gifts actually come from? In the last part of my show, I looked at song, so now I'd like to look at decorations. The use of decorating your home to mark an event, well, it's still a huge part of any celebration nowadays, isn't it? Our local garden centre, though, has had a fully stocked hall of Christmas decorations from the beginning of last September. And I feel it's such a shame, really, as it takes all the magic away from me, especially from the children, because they see the decorations for such a long time before Christmas Day itself. Our decorations didn't go up in the house until about a week before Christmas Day when I was little, and they were disappeared just as quickly by the 4th of January. I recall how plain the house looked after all the decorations had been taken down and put away. Bringing a bit of seasonal cheer from nature into the home to decorate the house, oh, that dates back before history books were written. Imagine how cold and bleak the winter nights must have been many thousands of years ago. I'm not surprised that evergreen greenery was brought into the house to add scent and colour and cheer, and to remind the occupants that spring would return again. Decorating the home with greenery from outside would have been a way to honour the gods and the goddesses of nature throughout the winter time. Small trees, plants, wreaths, garlands and boughs were cut and then brought inside to decorate the homes. Holly sprigs, well, they're still everywhere as motifs on cards and pullovers, aren't they? In the little branch form or as part of a wreath at the door. But did you know, in times long past, that the holly was considered to be the wood of choice to drive off evil spirits? I think there's a theme here. And it was essential to have it in every household during the darker half of the year, when most of the other trees were bare and the spirits would be at liberty to wander about the place. The holly bush is not only associated with those very early days, though. It's associated with the gods of winter. In pre-Christian pagan cultures, the holly was associated with the god of winter, the Holly King. And he was doing his annual battle with the Oak King of the summer. For Christians, the red holly berries represent the blood of Jesus Christ as he died upon the cross. And the sharp-edged green leaves are associated with Jesus' crown of thorns. The Romans, they loved to honour the god Saturn in December, and so their homes and hearths were decorated with boughs of greenery for vines and ivy and the like. And the ancient Egyptians, well, they used palm leaves from palm trees to mark the winter solstice. The palm tree was the symbol for them of resurrection and rebirth. We also include mistletoe, don't we, in our celebrations. It's actually one of the oldest and most established traditions as far as I can see. Now, in case you haven't seen it before, mistletoe is an evergreen plant that's covered in pearl-sized white berries from winter through to spring. And if you look up into the branches of tall trees, you'll see balls of spindly mistletoe hanging there, and they look to me like natural Christmas baubles in amongst the highest branches. Mistletoe is actually a plant that lives off the nutrients and water from the host tree. Host trees like the famous English oak, for example. Now, the Druids, who were the Celtic priests, they'd cut the mistletoe that grew on the oak trees and they'd give it to people as a blessing. Oaks were seen as sacred, and the winter fruit of the mistletoe was a symbol of life in the darker winter months. What a great combination. When we see mistletoe nowadays, I have to say it's usually been pre-harvested and then pre-packed into convenient-sized bunches, which we can then take home and hang above the entrance to our front door. But the tradition of bringing mistletoe into celebrations has been around for a very, very long time. Druids, Vikings and Romans, they've all used mistletoe to honour fertility rites of different kinds. Tales from the Norse folk tell of warriors from opposing tribes that met under mistletoe and then chose to lay down their arms. So it's certainly considered a plant of peace and reconciliation, isn't it? Also in Norse mythology, mistletoe is associated with Frigga, a goddess of love. I wonder if that's why a cheeky kiss under the mistletoe is still considered to be very magical even now. So bringing greenery inside the home during the winter solstice is definitely nothing new. I always buy a laurel wreath to hang outside my front door to greet my guests with. What do you do? Decorating the greenery is just as important. So the greenery that we bring inside is a big part of our celebration, and decorating is part of the celebration too. You can buy glittery baubles, glass baubles, funky and festive, traditional and tatty. And over the years, it has all found its way onto the Christmas tree in our house. I imagine homes have always been decorated with greenery in some way, shape or form, especially branches from trees and bushes that had brightly coloured berries on them. Think of that bright red and darkest green that we always like to have in our Christmas themes. I think that the tradition of adorning trees with ornaments actually was a Roman invention. Actually, thinking about it, it's probably way before that. But I do know that the Romans used ornaments representing gods and goddesses, and they would hang them in the trees outside their houses at the solstice time of year. I would expect that they also hung similar ornaments inside the houses too, when I think about it. So typically for the Romans, these ornaments would represent a god, maybe Saturn for the Romans, or perhaps a family's patron deity. Early Germanic tribes, they decorated their trees with fruit and candles in honour of Odin during the solstice. Now, unfortunately, outside our trees are covered in LED fairy lights. I'm thinking that I might actually have to change what happens in our garden this year. And I think the kind of ornament that I would like to hang in my tree is something that might be good for nature. Maybe I could buy or make some bird feeders that looked like baubles hanging from the branches, but that actually were there in order to help the wildlife instead. I think that's quite a good idea. I also have a handmade ornament that my son made me one Christmas when he was at nursery school. He made me an angel. It's an odd-looking and rather quirky thing, and as it's now approaching almost 30 years old, it's still in fairly good condition, all things considered. Every year, this angel sits in pride of place on the top of our Christmas tree, and it watches all the goings on, gazing down on us with a cockeyed grin. I really love that angel.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
This is the Future Self Energetic Show for UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Amanda Nelson, and I decided this week I would share some discoveries with you on my show today. Discoveries about the origins of some of the essential ingredients to creating a happy, festive celebration around the time of the winter solstice. Now, today, Christmas in the West feels to me like a huge gift-giving bonanza, and I think it benefits retailers far and wide, which is okay, but there's a certain amount of the frenzied purchasing that's lost on me. I know it can be fun, but it can also feel like a huge weight on your shoulders. I've got a bit of a problem with the levels of pressure that's placed on everyone to buy the right kind of gift, and my inner circle of friends also shy away from the overly commercial side of Christmas as well. It makes it much easier now that the children are older, of course, and I'm not being bar humbug at all, but to me it's all gone a bit far, and the gift of Christmas has been lost amongst the expectation, the hype, the pressure and the frenzy. As my kids turned into adults, I managed to free myself from this side of Christmas, and I reinvented how I wanted to give and also to receive gifts at Christmas time as well. I now encourage everyone to make their own gifts. I'm in the middle of decorating jars of jams and mincemeats and chutneys that I made during the autumn months, and I've even made a pretty good blackcurrant vodka and sloe gin this year. Little bottles of those will certainly find their ways into adult stockings for sure. These homemade treasures seem to go down really well when I've gifted them to loved ones in the past. And now friends and family have actually started asking me to make them these kinds of gifts instead. I think that's great. I'll put the recipes I love on my website at beyondthegoldenegg.com for you, so you've got them for next year. So gift giving, gift receiving, it's actually quite a new practice. It was developed within only the last 200 or 300 years. Most people who celebrate Christmas associate the practice of gift giving with the biblical tale of the three wise men. They came with gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh for the newborn baby Jesus. But the tradition can be traced right the way back to other cultures too. The Romans, they gave gifts between Saturnalia and the Calends, I think it's called. And during the Middle Ages, the French nuns, they gave gifts of food and clothing to the poor on St. Nicholas's Eve. Interestingly, up until around the early 1800s, most people exchanged gifts on New Year's Day. And it was typically just one present. When I was a child, the very most you could expect to receive in your stocking was one main gift and about five smaller ones. Including in those five smaller ones would be things like a small selection box of chocolate bars and a fresh orange. I was brought up to believe that you should always arrive at someone's home with a gift, not only during the festive season, but something to always share at any time of the year, really. It's not only homemade preserves that I might show up with, though. It could be some incense sticks that I think you might like, or a bunch of fresh flowers from my garden, perhaps a bottle of wine or two. One of the oldest gifts that I found out about that has been shared is actually the lowly fruit cake. Fruit cakes actually have their origins in ancient Egypt. I was fascinated by that. There's a tale in the culinary world that the Egyptians used to place cakes made of fermented fruit and honey on the tombs of their deceased loved ones. And presumably these cakes would last as long as the pyramids themselves. In later centuries, Roman soldiers would carry fruitcakes like these into battle, made with mashed pomegranates in them and barley. Sounds delicious. There are even records of soldiers on crusades carrying honey-laden fruitcakes into the Holy Land with them. Basically, once made, fruitcakes last and last. These would be a wonderful store cupboard treat, wouldn't they? So they'd be made in order to add something sweet and welcoming to the table throughout the coldest of pagan winters. And provided they didn't get eaten too quickly, I suppose they would have lasted and lasted. Fruitcake then was a store cupboard staple, a reliable addition to keep the wintry famines at bay. Now, it was traditional for everyone to make their own fruitcakes when I was growing up. It was hard to buy them in the shops in the way we can now. And every family seemed to very proudly have their own family recipe. And often these were closely guarded secrets. Now, my family had a favourite fruit cake as well. It was full of fruit, of course, but no little pips. We had to make sure that the currants and everything had no pips in them, as they stuck in my nanny's dentures and she didn't like that. And the secret ingredient was that the fruit had to have had a good soaking in sweet, strong tea with large amounts of teacher's whiskey added to it. So there was red cheeks all round in our house when I was growing up, as soon as that cake had been served up. The kids were only allowed one slice. I wonder why. So legend has it that once a fruit cake is baked, it will seemingly outlive everyone who comes near it. And it was certainly true of the whiskey-laced, no, let's tell it as it was, whiskey-drenched fruitcake that I knew and loved when I was growing up. I hope that we can return to giving things that are homemade, tempting and treatful again. In midwinter, what could be more welcome than a friendly smile on your doorstep and a preserve or a homemade tipple or delicious basket of treats to top up the larder? What kind of giving will you think of this year? That's it for another show. I'm so glad you joined me here for the Future Self Energetic Show on UK Health Radio this week. I present the Future Self Energetic Show every week on UK Health Radio, and I'd be delighted to spend more time with you again soon. The world of energy is amazing and it's magical and it's mysterious, and there's always so much for us to explore about it. You have a vital connection to a web of energy fields around you. Use that connection for your benefit. I've been working with vibrational energetics all my life, and I know that when you improve your energy fields, you can only up-level. Focus then on improving the quality of your energy field all the time, whenever you can, because it does have the potential to positively...